This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on July 15, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Let's turn to the next matter, the report to the Audit Division on Biden for President. And
good morning.
Good morning.
Before you is the report of the Audit Division on Biden for President, Inc., the principal campaign committee for Joseph Biden, a candidate for the Democratic Party's nomination for the office of president in 2008. The report contains six findings. The first finding is net outstanding campaign obligations. The audit staff's review of the committee's financial activity through September 30, 2009, and estimated winding down costs determined that the candidate did not receive matching fund payments in excess of his entitlement. Finding two, receipt of contributions that exceed limits. The audit staff's sample review of contributions from individuals indicated two things. First, that the projected dollar value of unresolved excessive contributions was $106,216. In its response to the preliminary audit report, the committee stated that it would make a payment to the U.S. Treasury after service of the final audit report. Second, that the projected amount of excessive contributions that were not resolved in a timely manner was $1,092,899, for which no repayment is required. All of these excessive contributions were presumptively designated for the general election. However, the committee did not retain copies of the letters sent to contributors as required by the regulations. The committee provided documentation such as declarations from contributors and from a committee staff member to support that the letters had been sent. However, commission regulations require that copies of all notices be retained for the presumptive redesignations to be effective, and the committee has not satisfied that requirement. Finding number three, prohibited in-kind contribution. The review of campaign travel identified one flight by the committee on a private aircraft that was not reimbursed using the charter rate, resulting in the receipt of an in-kind contribution of $26,889 from a corporation. In response to the preliminary audit report, the committee indicated that it would make a payment to the U.S. Treasury after service of the final audit report. Finding four, stale dated checks. The audit staff identified stale dated checks totaling $137,757, of which $85,900 remain unresolved. The committee's response indicated that it would make a payment to the U.S. Treasury after service of the final audit report. Finding five, disclosure of disbursements. 49 disbursements totaling $3,779,976 were not adequately disclosed. Approximately half of these disbursements were to its media vendor, and the purpose was incorrectly or inadequately disclosed. The remaining disbursements were to its credit card vendor, and the address was incorrectly disclosed. Subsequent to the exit conference, the committee filed amended reports that materially corrected the disclosure of these disbursements. Finding six, reporting of debts and obligations. The audit staff identified debt totaling $870,296 that was not disclosed on Schedules D, debts and obligations, as required. Subsequent to the exit conference, the committee filed amended reports that materially corrected the disclosure of these debts.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Is there anything further from Office of General Counsel? All right. Any questions or discussion? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to keep this tight and punchy. When this came around for a vote, I didn't approve it and I didn't object. I just didn't vote on paper ballot, which if there's not four affirmative votes, it comes to the table, and I thought that would be the way to do this because some of the issues I have, I think, are really going to cause me some issues with voting for at least one of these findings. other issues, I think, the audit report doesn't necessarily convey to the public what's happening with this campaign, and because some of this stuff is rather detailed and in the weeds. So the good news on this audit, I guess, is finding one, the net outstanding campaign obligations, that they didn't receive matching fund payments in excess of the entitlement. So as far as the matching funds portion, it seems like all is in order there, and that's the good news. The other findings, finding two, receipt of contributions that exceed limits. The issue here, as I understand it, was checks came in for dollar amounts more than the statutory limit, and they were from husbands and wives or for multiple elections, presumptively. And under the regs, a committee can accept those and then on paper reattribute or redesignate contributions to match up with the limits. The problem here, though, is there's a reg that talks about sending a letter within 60 days. And then there's another reg 4 pages later that talks about keeping a copy of the letter. And my understanding is that's the issue here, is that the committee was not able to produce copies of the letter that would support their presumptive redesignation or reattribution.
That's correct.
Right. They've offered other evidence, though, to demonstrate that the letters have been sent. The auditors have determined that it's not sufficient. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't under the reg. Maybe the reg is the exclusive way of doing it. That's not really how I read the reg, because I think the reg is a little murky, and I'll touch on that in a minute. But on the facts here, as I understand it, the treasurer of the committee was having some significant health problems and orally said she sent the letters, but they couldn't find the letters at the time. Then she passed away. So the person who sent the letters is no longer with us. The committee produced, I guess, the deputy to this person who said, I know the letters were sent because I saw them, something to that effect. But the committee still couldn't find at least a sample because their computers were already sold, because when you wind down a campaign, you sell off the assets. So the computers were gone. The person who sent the letters were, I'd say gone, but that's really disrespectful, she passed away. And third, they actually went out and found contributors to do declarations that said they remember getting these letters. So we have a lot of circumstantial evidence that these letters were sent. And I guess what I'd like to throw out for discussion is that enough? To me, given the facts of this case, I think that's enough to determine that the letters were sent. The fact that they didn't keep the letter, to me, is a record-keeping issue. It doesn't really affect the contribution limits issue. Because this has come up in a number of cases. Some were on the docket when I joined the commission. Really, the seminal case goes back years, which prompted a change in the rule to make it simpler. Senator Schumer had an audit and a lot of headlines about massive amounts of excessive contributions. Really, what happened was the paperwork wasn't right. He really didn't take too much money. He just didn't really do it correctly, because then you had to go to the contributor, get it signed. The contributor had to send it back. That reg is still on the books. In some instances, you still have to do that. But in others, the commission tried to make it simpler by letting the committee just realize that if someone sends you a $5,000 check, probably part of it's for the primary and probably part of it's for the general. But you do have to let the contributor know that and let them know you can refund the money. And the reg does say that you have to keep the letter. The campaign guides don't mention you have to keep the letter. The brochure, and I have the guide from 08 and the guide from 04, they don't seem to mention it, nor does the brochure. Not that that's a form of law, but this is the sort of thing I think has come up in audits, come up in MERS, and I hope at some point the commission can address it, because it seems like the more sophisticated operatives and their sophisticated candidates and sophisticated campaigns are the ones most likely to not do it because, well, it's a somewhat of a recent change. But to go through the reg, you have to flip through 4 pages to get to the part that says you're supposed to keep the letter. So it's a little bit tricky. That's not really the issue here. I think they did the letters. I don't have really any doubt that they didn't do the letters. But to sort of declare that this candidate took excessive money because, the treasurer passed away and the letters cannot now be found, I'm wondering if there's any appetite to, in this case, say that this is enough to determine that they satisfied their obligations. That's my first concern. I guess I'll leave it with that, because some of the other findings I have issues, but finding two is where I have my main concern about this audit.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share that concern. I struggled with this finding also. And actually, after the initial round of affidavits came in, they submitted an extra, more detailed affidavit from the deputy to the deceased treasurer. And in that one, he said, working at the direction of Ms. Whitaker, I prepared and sent presumptive designation notices to contributors who had contributed in aggregate more than $2,300. The notices were in the same form below, and they reproduce it. I would send these notices within 60 days of receipt of such contributions, and this is under penalty of perjury. So I think we have evidence that letters were sent. Do we have evidence that every single letter that should have been sent was sent? Maybe not. You know, it's sort of it's a general response. It's not, you know, and I sent this letter to this person and this letter to that person, and, you know, he couldn't possibly remember all that with, you know, the computer that been wiped and all the other problems. And I have always had a soft spot for committees who find themselves in a bind because their treasurers pass away, which unfortunately has happened a number of times in my tenure. And these redesignations have been a nightmare forever. The commission has tried for years to make it simpler for committees because, as you note, even sophisticated committees, people you would expect not to get it wrong, have gotten it wrong. Senator Schumer, Senator Specter, Senator Martinez, Representative Gephardt. I mean, we've had issues with all of them with redesignations, and now we have Vice President Biden. So it's not apparently something that continues to trip up even the most sophisticated campaigns, and particularly high-volume campaigns. You know, there's a lot of letters that you got to send because people are, you know, they say, oh, I can send 2,300 for the primary and 2,300 for the general. They write one check, and they we can't expect a high level of sophistication from the donors. And we keep trying to make it easier. In the time that I've been here, the commission has struggled to try and make this easier, and we can't seem to make it easy enough. But I'm happy to make another commitment to work with you to try and make it easier still again. The problem that I have here is that the regulation, convoluted though it may be, you know, when you get through all the pages of it, says the redesignation isn't effective unless you have a copy of the letter. And there's no dispute that they don't have a copy of the letter. So is this a record-keeping violation? I think plainly it is. You know, I think that the report actually could be clarified on that point. I mean, I was concerned when I read the report, particularly at page 11. Where is it? There's a discussion of sampling, and then there's a statement that within 30 days of service of the final audit report, the committee must submit a check to the United States Treasury for the total amount. And after several conversations with our staff, I've determined that what they mean there is the $106,000 that was not curable, not the $1 million that was curable. And they say, actually, not only was it curable, but they sent the letters on a timely basis. They just don't have copies of them. So I think at a minimum, we need to clarify that in the report, exactly what we're talking about, because this section talks about two different pots of money. One's $100,000 and one's $1 million. And there's obviously that extra zero makes a big difference. So I think, as I said, at a minimum, I think we need to clarify the report, and I agree with you that it is fundamentally a record-keeping problem. And if we can, you know, maybe there's a way of preserving, you know, I'm reluctant to say it was effective when the regulation says it's not effective without a copy of the letter. We know they don't have copies of the letter, but at the same time, clarify that this really is a record-keeping problem. It's not an excessive contribution problem. And I don't have that magical language with me at the moment, but I think that would probably be valuable.
Commissioner McGann.
I certainly don't have the magical language either, but I appreciate what you said, because I think it's important for the public to know that there's a difference between a campaign that takes excessive money and this situation, right? I mean, this is something that the commission says you can do, but the reg does sort of say, and I went through the reg a couple times last night just for fun, start to finish, and I got to tell you, it is a chore connecting the dots, because the part about the presumptive is on this page, and then you have to flip you know, that's two pages of regs, five pages over to get to the part about the committee shall retain documentation demonstrating. But then that sort of cross-references to another section that defines what the letter is. This was grafted onto the old rule, which is still the rule. So you read part of the rule, and it seems like you have to get it back, but you don't. When this rule was put in, it was intended to make things easier. And I have to give credit where credit's due, at least the media reports have said I've had some sharp questions for auditors. I have to give credit where credit's due. The auditors have struggled with this and have tried to come up with solutions in the course of audits so as to reach a more fair result. And they have shown flexibility, and I think that was a good approach. But this is the sort of thing that is going to keep coming up and coming up. Changing the regs and all this is a cumbersome thing because of what we need to do with the APA and whatnot, but it's something I think at some point we need to do. A couple approaches to think about in the interim, though, is to make it clear in audits that this is that kind of issue that we're talking about, not somebody taking, you know, illegal money that's, we have 10 grand checks in cash or something, because otherwise it gets all lumped in the same, and you know, you don't really, it just doesn't seem fair that there could be a headline saying, you know, Vice President Biden takes $1 million of excessive money, when really, technically, I guess you could say that. I'm not even sure that he did, because if the money comes in on one day, is it excessive when it comes in, or it's unexcessive when they send the letter, or it's only when they keep the letter? Timing-wise, when does it become legal? When is it excessive? When's it not? You get in this metaphysical circle of what's legal and what's not legal. And what if the treasurer had the letters? Was it legal, and then she passed away, and then it's illegal because now they can't find them? And this is in this case, they've done the best they can with who they have to say. And, of course, they don't remember if all the letters were sent and they can't say, because the person who knows is no longer with us. So it's tough to get your arms around this, and folks have gotten wrapped up in it. The first cycle where this was in play, I think, was the 2004 cycle. Any campaign of any size, the high-volume campaigns, as you suggest, some presidential, a lot of Senate races, got tripped up in this. The reg changed in the middle of their election cycle, right? Because presidential's on a 4-year cycle, Senate's on a 6-year cycle. This reg came into being early 2000s. So they were within the 6 years, but yet they got tripped up, and gradually the commission realized this was going to be more of a problem. One suggested solution, and the auditors sort of allude to this in the report indirectly on page 12, where they talk about, in the facts and analysis, they talk about online credit cards, and they talk about some of the contributions received to the internet website. The website did not provide sufficient notice to the contributor to constitute an attribution of a portion of the contribution to another person or to designate a portion of the contribution to the general election, because it just said you can accept up to $2,300. Something I've floated once in a while before, but not in a public meeting, open meeting, is that there ought to be a way that if the response device makes clear to the contributor what the committee is going to do with the money, meaning you can give 23 per election, 46, you know, per, they're separate elections, and if you give this much money, we're going to split it up, you know, husband and wife check. We don't want to get a whole, you know, 20 pages of boilerplate that no one reads, but there's got to be a way that when people give money, the response device that they have to fill out for their occupation and employer already notifies them of what the committee's doing, and it saves the burden of the letter. When this rule was promulgated, there was notice and comment. I commented before I joined the commission, and I don't remember even worrying about maintaining the letter or the record-keeping obligation. You have to keep a copy of every letter you sent, and when you're a large campaign, that's a lot of letters, and it's a lot of postage, and it's a lot of envelopes, and some may think, well, what's the big deal? It actually adds up, and when the best efforts reg went in, folks actually litigated it on that issue, and the courts in that instance said, well, it doesn't really sound like that much because you don't have to keep a copy of the letter. For best efforts, you really just keep a sample. Here you have to keep every copy of the letter. We don't want people just making it up as they go along and avoiding the contribution limits. The way the law is trending, contribution limits are really something that one of the few things left in a lot of ways, and it's important to maintain them. On the other hand, we have to do it in a way that I think reflects reality. More contributions are coming online. there's got to be a way that the contributors notified when they are solicited that the money is going to be lined up to match up with the limits. It also, as a practical matter for campaigns, helps because when you hire a lawyer, the lawyer doesn't really check to see if you kept the letters, but they review your response devices. So it gives those who actually worry about all this nitty-gritty, treasurers worry about it, but other people other than treasurers, an opportunity to actually vet it and get the language right at that instance, which I think avoids a lot of this cumbersome after-the-fact thing that I know the auditors have been struggling with, because I think in their heart of hearts, they look at it and they say, this isn't the same as somebody taking massive amounts of illegal money. But the reg says what it says, and what's frustrating is the reg was designed to help, but then when it gets put together in the book, it ends up being all spread out in the book, and it's very tough to follow. And as I said, the guides don't tell you to keep the letter. So if you're just sort of doing the quick and dirty, it's really easy to say, oh, as long as you send a letter within 60 days, you're fine. And I've even been in legal briefings given by others where they don't mention, hey, you got to keep the letter. So these folks don't have the letter, and here we are, you know, saying that they took a lot of excessive contributions when really it's not the same. So maybe we can figure out a way to do a policy statement or something in the interim so that people can get this under control. But I can keep going on it, but I'm glad we at least agree that it's a record-keeping issue. It's not the same, and if the public isn't informed by now, then they're not listening to the tape or here. So I appreciate the indulgence. I don't know if anyone else has thoughts on the issue, but I don't want to keep droning on.
Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I share a lot of my colleagues' concerns about doing something in the future, and I'm happy to do that. With respect to this particular audit, I think they obviously knew about the 60-day requirement, and I think there is circumstantial evidence, as the auditors state. I think, frankly, their conclusion to this discussion in the report on page 15 is accurate, and perhaps we need, you know, as now that we have a new procedure for writing the commission's audit report, maybe this particular thought could be amplified. It sounds like maybe we all, you know, share this concern, and maybe it can be amplified. It says, although VFP has provided some circumstantial evidence that redesignations were sent, code site requires that copies of all notices be retained for presumptive redesignations to be effective, and they have not satisfied that requirement. I think that was Commissioner Weintraub's concern as well, and I think that's an accurate statement. To the extent that, you know, in our report, we want to amplify that, I think that would be a perfectly plausible way to move forward. I would note that there are, you know, two areas here of two different types of issues. There is the $106,000, which the committee indicates that it. There are unresolved excessives of about $106,000, and that it will make payments based on those. So I assume we would split those out and then deal with the other that are based on the letters. And, you know, while there is a lot of circumstantial evidence, and I think, frankly, from my perspective, this is a very unusual situation. Obviously, they no longer have the personnel with them who maybe could have provided us with either, you know, a more concrete affidavit or perhaps would know where the files are. So I think it's a little bit difficult to, in this very unusual circumstance, and I think that is an important point as well, that I would like us to note in the report, just because I think that it is a very unusual circumstance. I think they tried to do the right thing here. They knew it, you know, so it's not a question of whether they knew they had to send the letters. They also probably knew they had to keep them because they said they had them at one point. It just, they appeared to be missing. And unfortunately, the person who probably has that information has passed away. So just in an effort, I guess, to sort of see how we can move this particular finding, it seems to me that with respect to the excesses that total $216, that could be perhaps treated separately, and then the others with respect to the letters could be treated separately, and again amplify the view that that the copies were not retained. There is circumstantial evidence to say that they sent them, but they did not meet the record-keeping requirement.
Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that is a very constructive suggestion because as I was reading this, I was getting confused about when we were talking about the 106 and when we were talking about the million. So I think separating out the discussion would be helpful and would make it all more transparent and more comprehensible to anybody who might have the misfortune to be reading this report at some later date and would not have the benefit of our illuminating conversation at the table. I also just on the general topic of reattributions and redesignations, I just want to note that I've had a longstanding concern on the subject of reattributions, which I think are different from redesignations. It's one thing to say somebody sends a check for $5,000. Obviously, that person is a supporter and they want to give the money, and you know, it seems like fair to assume or presume that, you know, they would want to give the max for the primary and then, you know, have the rest of it go towards the general. When you're talking about two different individuals, I generally agree with my husband's politics, but there are couples where they don't. And I'm reluctant. I've always been a little bit more reluctant. I mean, you know, we could talk about James Carville and Mary Matlin. How'd you like to reattribute, you know, their contributions? That could be a little bit tricky. I think we need to have some kind of I don't want to make life overly complicated for these campaigns, but I also think that there needs to be somehow a distinction made between these two situations, because when you're talking about one person who writes a check and the assumption is, oh, well, that must have been for the couple because it's a joint checking account, and then you send something back or you get something back and it's signed by the same person who signed the check, that's not necessarily an indication that that person's spouse actually agrees with them and wanted to support the same candidate. I know couples like that, and, you know, in my own personal circle, putting aside the more famous ones. So I think whatever we end up doing, we have to be sensitive to that concern and make sure that we are not, allowing people to bust the contribution limits on the, you know, because they've got a fig leaf because they happen to be married and they think they can give more money, or B, forcing somebody to make a contribution without even their knowledge because, you know, they've got a spouse who's writing the checks and not bothering to consult them about it. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, one spouse just might not even know that their spouse is secretly supporting the other candidate. They might not bring it up at home. They want to avoid the fight, but, you know, they still might not want their money going to support the spouse's preferred candidate. So I just think we need to be sensitive to that issue.
Commissioner McGann.
I remember years ago you made that point. And at the time, I thought, well, I guess that could come up, you know, and there is the fear that one spouse writes the check, the other spouse doesn't know. But as time went on, the more I thought about it, the more it started making a lot more sense. And now I think it really is not just the concern that the husband's writing checks and claiming it's for his wife or vice versa or their politics are different, but if one spouse is a registered lobbyist, or if one spouse maxes out and the aggregate, you know, the two-year biannual limit. I mean, there's a lot of landmines there, and it is an issue that you know, on the one hand, you think that's not a big deal, but the more Congress passes laws that put restrictions on or disclosure obligations on people, or things that are designed to break, you know, the link between money and official policy, the more it matters to get this kind of thing right. I think if someone writes in this cycle, the limit was $2,300 per election. If they write a check that's, $4,600 before the primary, it's probably primary in general. You know, that's a pretty safe assumption that people aren't going to write, just pick that number out of the sky, right? But I agree with the concern, and that's something else I think we need to address because times change, and I think the rules need to reflect that that reality. Statute only goes so far. The rules have to give life and really have it apply to what's actually happening in the field. So I appreciate that. And I apologize for not looking up. I was actually trying to read the reg and figure out the presumptive thing. And actually where it says you keep the letter, it's really just at one point, it seems like it just says retained documentation demonstrating, but that's actually another, if that cross-references another part, it's a mess. It's a mess. The final question I have, and the point I think that needs to be made on the $1 million, is that's just a, that's a sample, right? That's a projection. That's not a real dollar amount. You do sampling because the high volume campaigns, statistically, it gives you kind of a guess. Any sense of what the whenever you do a sample, there's going to be a range, there's going to be a margin of error. I think there's a 5% chance that this is not even within your range.
Yes.
Okay. What, any sense what the low number is on your range? Because when you do a sample, you're going to sort of project. And I think this is going to be a number somewhere in between 2 points. What's any idea what the low water mark is on this? Because it's going to be significantly less than a million.
About 742,000.
Okay. All right. I just do that to help the public understand so that people don't think, well, there's $1 million of excessives. It could be that. It could be seven. It could be more. And there's a 5% chance it's less than seven.
Yeah, 5% chance that it's either less than seven or more than,
or more than
13,
right,
or 14 or right. 1.3, 1.4.
Right. So it's just a sample I guess sufficient for audit purposes, but people necessarily can't take the number to the bank. So I just want to make that clear, because sometimes people just gloss over that and they say the wrong kind of thing. Finding three, it seems like they didn't realize that the plane was an FAA plane. They paid a rate for what would have been okay for a plane that wasn't a commercial plane, and they found out after the fact, and they've made all the corrections on that, right? So that's under control. Stale data checks, the same. That happens, right? People write checks, and they get stale. And this finding five, I have a couple questions about that. Where it's a 49 disbursements totaling over $3.7 million that were not adequately disclosed. Mm-hmm. And this is something I've talked about before, about incorrect or inadequate purposes, as well as incorrect addresses. I'd like to flesh that out a little bit. My understanding is that the incorrect address deals with primarily their credit card, which is Bank of America, and they had an address that they're reporting for Bank of America that when you ask them, they really couldn't figure out where they got that address from. But they've now found the correct address for the Bank of America credit card, and they've done amendments to correct that, right? That's been corrected?
That's correct.
Banks have all kinds of addresses for when you apply for the account, pay the bill, inquiries, you know, that kind of thing. Pure speculation, my guess is the address was on something they got when they first got the card, and they probably, it's probably a P.O. box. It's probably, you know, they probably have a P.O. box that they were using, and they just never bothered to check to see what they were really reporting. I mean, there's nothing sinister about this that you've uncovered, right?
No, okay. Not at all.
The second is the descriptions. They paid one consultant quite a bit of this money. Which is common for a campaign. They have a general consultant that does all kinds of things. And they reported most of it as media and strategy.
They reported most of it as consultant fee.
Did they have any sort of descriptive off of the word consultant? I thought they said consulting fee, media/strategy. I thought that was their...
That's correct. That's okay. What I believe the correct disclosure was.
Because I'm looking at the public document that the commission made public about 3-4 years ago about what the reports analysis division would deem to be a sufficient description, because what was happening was folks were making descriptions and they get a letter questioning the description, and then I think the commissioner said, why don't we just tell the public what RAD thinks is okay, and essentially it was the RAD sheet that went public. But when I read that sheet, consultant for media, that seems to be on the list of sufficient. Why are these not sufficient?
We don't believe that accurately describes the goods and services being provided. The goods and services being provided were travel expenses, production costs, those kind of thing. Actually, media buys, too, I believe.
I could see breaking down the difference between production and the buy, although I'm not sure everyone does that, and I'm not sure that's required under the regs. I mean, maybe in the policy statement that you're supposed to do that. I'm not entirely sure. But some of this, you know, media travel is, I think, what the invoice said, and they reported it as media. I'm not sure that has to be reported as media travel. I think that comes under production. Now, I guess people can disagree on that, but there's no affirmative thing in the law that, that really differentiates. And I'd hate to be in a situation where we're nitpicking campaigns. They've done the amendments. They've complied, as I understand it, with your recommendations. So the reports have all this detail. But my understanding is at one point you suggested, and I guess they made the amendment, that production, they actually had to break down as a line item dial testing. No, we never
said that. That's what the invoice said. We never said that they had to be that specific. We just said put production.
Okay, so that was sufficient. They don't actually have to break it down that much. So it's really just production and the buy. We had to separate. They didn't have to break down subsets of production or subsets of the media buy?
No.
Okay.
No. And if I might add, on the credit card, we did try to contact Bank of America and find out if there was any record of that address, and they were unable to help. So we were hoping we would find that it was on something that they had gotten, and the Bank of America would recognize the address, but no luck.
Okay. The final is reporting debts and obligations. This is another thing that's come up time and time again. And more audits are making this finding. It's coming up in MERS, Reports Analysis Division questions it. And the concern I have is that the commission is not really explaining to the public what it expects. The reg says one thing, and it says what it says. I'm not really challenging the finding necessarily with respect to being inconsistent with the reg. But the problem I see and that I've seen time and time again is that a campaign is a cash-based system, right? Money comes in. When it hits the bank, that's when you report it. Generally, when you pay the bill, that's when it gets reported. But that's where the breakdown occurs, because then sometimes some bills are sort of on an accrual basis, meaning it's when the obligations occurred. Now, there's some rationale for this that probably made a lot of sense when the reg was passed and still makes sense today. If someone signs a contract in February that they agree to pay $10,000 a month to somebody throughout the election cycle, you probably should show that as having happened in February so the public knows that the campaign's obligated to spend 10 grand, so you kind of get an accurate picture of their cash on hand. People could hide the ball otherwise. But in the modern age, it's getting to the point where I think we need to do something on this, because in this case, most of these were, or at least a significant portion of this dollar amount here in the audit, or was a credit card. And as I understand it, with credit cards, you have a variety of dates you can pick. It could be when you actually buy the good. It could be when the credit card charges your account. I guess it could be the invoice date, which would be I guess that could be the date of the credit card statement, which really isn't a real date. That's kind of just when the credit card company sends it to you. Or it's when the bill is due. Now, most people who run cash businesses, for example, are going to think that they don't have any debt if they pay their credit card bill by the date the credit card bill says you have to pay by, right? Ask anyone on the street, are you in debt? And they're going to say, no, I pay all my bills on time. But under the FEC regs, everybody's in debt as soon as they use a credit card. And it gets kind of silly. I've heard operatives say, so when we turn on the light switch on the wall, we've incurred a debt. We have to report that we're going to have an electric bill someday. And the regs actually say you have to at some point guess, estimate, anticipate what the number would be if you're not sure. The light example is an absurd example. That's not what the reg says, but people have sort of, using hyperbole, have mocked the reg by coming up with absurd examples. The problem, though, with credit cards is that they are due at a certain date. Banks are squeezing people more and more on the due date. And because folks are reporting more often, the law has changed and now they have more reports, the payment of bills and this debt issue has really popped, because if you're doing just quarterly reports, it wasn't as big a deal. The more and more people have to file monthly reports, whether it's campaigns or PACs, all of a sudden you're really going to be showing massive amounts of debt every month, where you really don't have debt in the common sense term of the word. And I'm wondering if we're actually requiring people to report things as debt that voters don't really think is debt, and creating almost too much information in the eyes of the public and potentially confusing people, because it looks like everybody's in debt all the time when really they're not. I'm not saying in this case we have to change it. I'm throwing it out there probably for future discussion. But given that when the rule was passed, people really didn't use credit cards. There was some, you know, MasterCharge and Bank of America. I remember the TV commercials. And campaigns really didn't use credit cards. More and more campaigns are using credit cards for massive amounts of money, and more you have to, because you have your ethics rules, and you have your personal use rules, and you have your campaign rules, and you always want to have a campaign credit card to make sure that you don't pay for something inadvertently using taxpayer money or the wrong kind of money. So credit card use has gotten to be more and more over the years. And I don't think the rules, when they were written, thought about where we are now with how people actually pay bills. And maybe people think they're in debt when they go and they buy something at Target and they put it on their credit card. I don't. I just think I'll pay the bill when it comes in the mail, or I'll pay it online or whatnot. And, you know, as long as it's current and I don't have an outstanding balance, I don't think I have debt. But in the FEC world, under the regs, you do, and you'd have to report that. And committee after committee after committee after committee is getting caught up in this. And this committee's gotten caught up in it. And at some point, I think we need to modernize this rule because of the use of credit cards, because of the increased reporting obligations that committees face. It's providing information overload and not really accurately presenting debt. If there's really debt, someone hasn't paid their consultant in a long time, you know, they've signed a contract where they have to pay rent every month, but even that I don't think has to get paid, because that's a recurring obligation. The reg is written for a different era. And I think it's important when people read these audit reports to understand that what most of this money is concern credit cards. There's some for a consultant, but am I right in my assumption that the bulk of this money was credit card bills?
That's correct.
Okay. So maybe there's an appetite to modernize this, but I appreciate the indulgence, Mr. Chairman, to go on this finding. I don't have a way to change the finding. Because I think what I said here today will speak for itself, and anyone who really cares to dig it out at least be in the, you know, the folklore of this audit somewhere. But it's something that I think we do need to do, and I hope at some point once we get some other work done, we turn to this, because this is another one of these things in the weeds that folks out there in the field get caught up in all the time, and it's just frustrating, because we need to identify where people are really playing hide the ball and incurring debt, and make sure people on the outside, the voters, know that, versus, you know, routine credit card payments that, you know, you buy something in the middle of 1 month, you pay off the credit card within 20 days, but then you file a report having to show debt that you've already paid off. It just doesn't make any sense. I guess you could do a memo entry saying that, but then that's even more reporting obligations. It gets complicated, and I've said my piece on that, and I thank the chair for the time on that, and that's all I have on this audit report.
Any further discussion? Why don't we take just a very brief recess? Back in order. On this audit report, I think the main issue kind of outstanding is how we're going to treat finding two. And just talking with my colleagues, it sounds like we may have some agreement on how we want to treat finding two and how it's discussed in the final audit report of the commission. One would be that this finding considers more than just the receipt of contributions that exceed limits, but also talks about related record-keeping obligations, and that we'll want to, I think, modify the title to reflect that, so that would say receipt of contributions that exceed the limits and related record-keeping obligations or requirements, however we want to say it. And there really are two things going on here. There were the $106,000 that was cured through a check to the Treasury, and then there's the sample, which led to the $1,092,000 number, which is where all the complications of the facts here, where with a treasurer that's now deceased, declaration stating that the letters were sent. We don't necessarily have the letters that were sent. But this element of this finding really appears to be more of a record keeping, that there's evidence that they sent the letters, but the one thing that we are clear on is that they didn't maintain the records that are required by the rules, and that the narrative be uh, that the narrative reflect that that reality, and that, that the problem here really is the failure to maintain the required records under the rule. I think that that's where we may be headed, but is there anything that I missed on that discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Just that it be broken out into two separate sections under that heading, so that it's very clear that, you know, in one, what we're saying about the 106 versus what we're saying about the million.
Any further questions or any comments from the auditors?
No, I think we have it.
Okay. Do we have a motion? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move we adopt the findings of the Audit Division in the report on Biden for President, Inc., and instruct the Audit Division to prepare the Commission's audit report to reflect the discussions at the table, particularly with respect to Finding 2's discussion of the receipt of contributions of that exceed the limits and related record-keeping requirements, to separate out those two discussions, identify the manner in which the evidence provided by the committee and the extenuating circumstances that existed for this committee.
Any further discussion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 5-0. Mr. Staff Director, do we have any management or administrative matters to discuss?
No, Mr. Chairman, there are none.
All right. Hearing none, meeting's adjourned.